This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
So glad to have you listening in today. This is Trumpet Hour. I'm Joel Hilliker. How much do you value free speech and freedom of religion? These freedoms enshrined in America's Bill of Rights are very rare, very precious, and they're under vicious attack right now in America. If you've been taking them for granted, you are quickly losing that luxury. Later in the program, we'll talk about how the new presidential administration is coming after those rights and about just how special those rights are. Before that, though, we're going to hear a couple of reports from our Trumpet writing team about important moves the Trump administration made in its final days. We'll start the show today by hearing a report from Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about how President Trump's team charged the Chinese government with genocide. What's taking place in the Xinjiang region of China against the Uyghur population there is atrocious, and the Trump administration held it to account. We'll talk about why and what this means going forward. Then we'll hear from Trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about two more steps the Trump team took. First, the 1776 Commission Report, which sought to revive appreciation for America's founding and its Constitution. And second, the U.S. recognizing the City of David, a key portion of Jerusalem, as a place of American heritage abroad. Brent will show how these two moves highlight the biblical roots of America's Constitution and its values. We'll start now by hearing about America's declaration against China in this report from Jeremiah Jacques.
The day before President Donald Trump vacated the White House, his administration dealt a major parting blow to China. It declared that the Chinese government's brutal repression of the Uyghur people in the Xinjiang region of China equates to genocide. This term genocide is not one that's used casually. It's not bandied about because it has a very specific meaning and it describes an especially heinous and far-reaching crime. The Department of Justice defines genocide in Section 1091 of Title 18 of the U.S. Code. It says it includes, quote, violent attacks with the specific intent to destroy, in part or in whole, a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group. So that's a very specific meaning, and most of us are familiar with this concept of genocide from the most well-known example of it in recent memory, and that is the Nazi government's attempt last century to exterminate Europe's Jewish population. So genocide is about a systematic effort to blot out a certain group, whether that group is defined by its race, ethnicity, religion, or nationality. And the facts in Xinjiang, China, show that this is what China is accomplishing with the Uyghurs. These are ethnically Turkic people. They are religiously Muslim, for the most part, and a strong majority of them actually aspire to be an autonomous nation, free of Chinese rule. So the Uyghurs of Xinjiang fit several of the group classifications in the Justice Department's definition. Now, there is a notable difference between what the Nazis of Germany aimed to accomplish with the Jews and what the Chinese aimed to accomplish with the Uyghurs. And that is that the Nazis just wanted to kill all the Jews. Even if a Jew happened to convert to Christianity, that didn't matter. Adolf Hitler believed their bloodline was the problem. Their race was what was wrong, and nothing could change that. So they had to be killed, completely annihilated, no questions asked. But the Chinese Communist Party, under Xi Jinping, hopes that it can actually assimilate the Uyghurs into Han Chinese culture. So it will kill any Uyghurs who resist this attempt at assimilation, and countless Uyghurs have already died as a result of it. But what China prefers is just killing their culture, wiping out their religion, and converting all of them to the Han Chinese religion, which is really atheistic worship of the state. They say there's no God, there's no higher power than the Communist Party, and the Chinese are hell-bent on making the Uyghurs abandon their faith and convert to that Chinese worldview. I spoke recently with Mr. Salih Hudaiar. He's the prime minister in exile for the Uyghur people, and he said, quote, "There is no God in communism, so Uyghurs are being brainwashed to literally worship the Chinese state as the highest being," end quote. So that's the Chinese Communist Party's goal. And it's clearly different from the Nazis' goal, but this difference ends up being mostly a technicality. It doesn't change the fact that China is committing genocide against these people. The way it's happening is mostly in concentration camps that the Chinese have built in Xinjiang over the last few years. Conservative estimates say the Chinese Communist Party has placed more than 1 million of Xinjiang's Uyghurs into these camps so far, and Mr. Hudayar said the true figure is closer to 3 million. And there are only some 10 million Uyghurs to begin with. So this is an astounding percentage of these people. And once a Uyghur is inside one of these camps, they are made to renounce their religion. They're forbidden from praying, and they're forced to consume pork and alcohol, which they view as very serious sins. And they're made to essentially worship the Communist Party. And the facts clearly show that any Uyghurs who resist are tortured and abused in every way you can imagine. And they are being murdered in great numbers. So murdering may not be the primary goal for the Chinese, but it is an option that they're perfectly willing to use. Conservative estimates say that tens of thousands have been killed so far, and it's likely well into the hundreds of thousands. So this is evil on a scale that's hard to even comprehend. And unlike the Holocaust, China's genocide is happening right now, in 2021. It's happening every day, and it has been since 2017 or earlier. And that's why it's entirely appropriate that the Trump administration stepped up last week and, as a parting blow, applied the deadly serious label of genocide to what China's doing in Xinjiang. One section of the Trump administration's declaration about this calls it a, quote, systematic attempt to destroy Uyghurs by the Chinese party state. And then it says this genocide is ongoing and represents, quote, an extreme affront to the Uyghurs, the people of China, and civilized people everywhere. Another section of this declaration enumerates many of the specific atrocities. It mentions forced sterilizations, forced abortions, forced marriages of Uyghur women to non-Uyghur men. And it lists many others. And then it says, with this report, the U.S. has worked exhaustively to pull into the light what the Communist Party and General Secretary Xi Jinping wish to keep hidden through obfuscation, propaganda, and coercion. We will not remain silent. End quote. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is the one who wrote this scathing declaration on behalf of the Trump administration, and I think it's commendable that he goes on from there to point out how bizarre it is that all of this is happening inside of China, even as the Chinese Communist Party leaders simultaneously assert their country as a global leader, and even as they are attempting to remold the international system in their image. He writes, quote, if the Chinese Communist Party is allowed to commit genocide and crimes against humanity against its own people, imagine what it will be emboldened to do to the free world in the not-too-distant future. So Pompeo is saying there that what's happening in Xinjiang right now shows what China will do globally if it keeps gaining power. And if you look at Bible prophecy, you see that he's right. The atrocities happening to the Uyghur people really should act as a warning to the rest of the world. During his ministry on earth, Jesus Christ talked about a global era that would begin shortly before his return. Luke 21:24 records him calling this era the times of the Gentiles. In the Trumpet's February 2020 issue, Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury discusses this era in detail. He writes, quote, these times of the Gentiles are yet to be fully realized. However, we are in the outer edges of this catastrophic storm. End quote. And then from there, Mr. Fleury talks about how American and British leadership for many years was an imperfect but a stabilizing force for civilization. Those countries had biblically influenced beliefs in the God-given rights of individuals. They championed the rule of law, and they fought against the injustice of government tyranny. So they did stabilize the world. But that era is now ending, and the times of the Gentiles is beginning. And Mr. Fleury says that in this new era, we can expect two main groups to become the primary global powers. One of them centers around Germany, and one of them around Russia and China. And in this new era that the world is now moving into, the rule of law will be just a memory. It'll be the same situation with limitations on government power. That will all be history. In Mr. Fleury's article, he actually specifically mentions the barbarity happening in Xinjiang, and he says that it is a preview of just how tumultuous the times of the Gentiles will be for the whole world. So it is a very dark era that the world is beginning to enter into, but Mr. Fleury also shows that there's a tremendous amount of good news, the best news we could ever hear, tied closely to all of this. And he shows that that dark era will not last long, just a few years, and it'll transition directly into an age of true and lasting peace and prosperity.
Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. It's refreshing to hear these words coming from the United States in light of everything that we're seeing happening in the world today with other nations. We've been talking about this deal that the European Union struck with China recently, where they're increasing their trade relationship with China. It seems like generally there's a real lack of will to stand up to exactly these kinds of atrocities, even though the evidence is very clear. But here it seems like it's something about the Trump administration that you saw repeatedly, that there was a general willingness to stand up where others didn't.
That's true, yes. The Trump administration really was leading the world in the fight against China. You know, it's very notable that the U.S. was the first nation to apply this genocide label to what China's doing there with the Uyghurs. And I also think it's notable that in the statement about this, Secretary of State Pompeo really called the world to task. You know, one part of the report says, the U.S. calls upon China immediately to release all arbitrarily detained persons. We further call on all appropriate multilateral and relevant juridical bodies to join the U.S. in our effort to promote accountability for those responsible for these atrocities. You know, so this means that other countries will have to think long and hard about continuing to do business with multinationals that have operations in Xinjiang. You know, this also comes just 2 weeks after the U.S. Imposed a ban on all cotton from Xinjiang, since so much of it is picked with forced labor by these Uyghurs. And Xinjiang is where most of the world's cotton comes from, a huge percentage of it, I think around 70 or 80%. So America is taking the lead here against China in an admirable way, but I'm not really all that optimistic about other nations following that lead.
Well, yeah, or even America continuing in that trend. There was a few headlines talking about how the Biden administration seems like it's willing to hold kind of a firm line against China. It's hard to see that continuing to any great degree, given the degree to which Joe Biden has been shown to be compromised by his relations with the Chinese government. If America isn't taking the lead, it's hard to see how anyone else would. And as I said before, a lot of other nations just seem to be very much willing to allow China to rise in power the way that it has been.
Yeah, you make a great point. The Biden administration has said that they plan to keep this label of genocide and keep the ban on cotton. But, you know, I think those words ring fairly hollow, given just how much we see that the Biden family is beholden to the Chinese. So it's hard to know if even the U.S. will really maintain this stance. And of course, the other nations that used to look to us for leadership do so less and less. There's a lot of money to be made by maintaining operations with the Chinese. So I think it's a darker chapter we're entering into here.
And Secretary Pompeo calling on these international bodies to stand up to China, really, what bodies are there? I mean, you really are talking about bodies that are made up of individual nations that, as you said, are very likely to prioritize their own economic interests over trying to hold some firm moral principle.
Yeah, that's a great point. And really, if you look at this specific situation, the main multilateral body that comes to mind for something like this is the International Criminal Court. They would normally be the ones to investigate crimes of genocide. But China China is not a member of that court. So that means that the Xinjiang genocide would have to be referred by the United Nations Security Council. And of course, China is one of the five permanent members of that council. That means they have veto power, and they could easily veto such a move. They could also call on Russia to veto it with them so that it doesn't look entirely one-sided. But even without Russia, a Chinese veto would keep much of anything from coming of this. And that really exposes the fundamental problem with the United Nations. You know, you've got these opportunistic, ruthless powers on the Security Council, and that means that very little good can actually come from it.
Well, as you brought out in the report, we are witnessing the transition of an age of Anglo-American dominance to one ruled by non-Israelite powers, and you get a really strong sense of just what that means when you look at the kind of activities that, say, China and some of these countries are involved in, a very different age than the one that we have been through for really the last couple hundred years. And biblical prophecy definitely shows us just the dangers that are involved in that transition. We appreciate your report very much, Jeremiah. We've been talking about one of the Trump administration's last moves while in power, declaring China's activities against the Uyghurs genocide. He's written an article on the subject, Parting Blow, Trump Administration Charges China with Genocide. You can check that out at thetrumpet.com. Thanks so much, Jeremiah.
Thanks very much for having me.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Also in its final hours in office, the Trump administration made a couple of decisions that really underscore America's biblical heritage, as we will now learn in this report from Brent Noctegal.
On January 18, the Trump administration issued two reports related to America's founding and its heritage. The first was this report of the 1776 Commission, which calls on the United States citizens to rededicate themselves to the values of America's Declaration of Independence and its primary source of law, the Constitution of the United States. The 1776 report should not be a controversial document. Yet immediately upon taking office, just 2 days later, Mr. Biden deleted the commission from the White House website. Now, if any are confused over the history of the founding of the United States, and also what its leaders for the past centuries have thought of that document, the Constitution, it's worth reading the report. Significantly, the report documents the biblical roots of the Constitution of the United States. In its conclusion, it says this: "The United States has journeyed far since its founding. While the founders certainly had disagreements about the nature of religion, they had little doubt that faith was essential to the new experiment in self-government and republican constitutionalism. They knew that citizens who practiced the faith under the protection of religious liberty would support the Constitution that embodies their rights. The shared morality of its faithful citizens would sustain a republican culture that would foster stable family relationships and encourage important virtues like fortitude to defend the nation in war, self-restraint over physical appetites or lust for wealth, compassion toward neighbors and strangers in need, self-discipline labor, intellectual integrity, independence from long-term reliance on private or public benefits, justice in all relationships, prudence in judging the common good, courage to defend their rights and liberties, and finally, piety toward the Creator, whose favor determines the well-being of society. We have arrived at a point where the most influential part of our nation finds these old faith-based virtues dangerous, useless, or perhaps even laughable. At the same time, many Americans feel that we have veered off the path that has brought so many happiness and success, and fear a growing factionalism cannot be overcome merely by electing a different president or political party. How can America overcome this partisan divide? The answer to this rising concern must begin by frankly and humbly admitting that the common ground of equal natural rights on which our common morality is based is no longer visible to many Americans. We must refocus on the proposition that united this nation from the beginning, the proposition of the Declaration of Independence, that there are self-evident truths which unite all Americans under a common creed. But it's almost impossible to hold this creed, which describes what and who we are, without reference to the Creator, as the ultimate source of human equality and natural rights. This is the deepest reason why the founders saw faith as the key to good character as well as good citizenship, and why we must remain one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all." End quote. In this conclusion to the 1776 Commission's report, and throughout the report itself, there is a strong connection to the biblical roots of Americans' founding. And yet, 2 days after it was published, this report was deleted. You have one American administration that wants to strengthen the Constitution, strengthen its connection to the Bible, to make it known, to revere it, to publish it. And you have another American administration that wants to blot that history out. Now you go to the White House website, and you will not see that commission that was published on January 18. But that was only one report from the Trump administration that day. The second was released by the United States Embassy in Jerusalem. While separated by a vast ocean and in a separate country, this declaration from Jerusalem has everything to do with the 1776 commission. In this case, it's a press release from the United States Embassy in Israel. This was the last press release of the United States Embassy here in Jerusalem under the leadership of Ambassador David Friedman. It reads this way. "The United States Embassy in Jerusalem, together with the United States Commission for the Preservation of America's Heritage Abroad, have recognized the City of David as a testament to America's Judeo-Christian heritage and founding principles. The archaeological discoveries at the City of David bring biblical Jerusalem back to life and reaffirm the prophetic messages of freedom, justice, and peace that inspired America's founders." U.S. Ambassador to Israel David Friedman and Chairman of the Commission for the Preservation of America's Heritage Abroad, Paul Packer, recently attended a special ceremony dedicating a plaque to honor the City of David in recognition of the seminal role it plays in connecting its visitors to the origins of the values that helped shape America. In dedicating the plaque, Ambassador Friedman said this. "In modern America, we are inspired by many monuments that remind us of the history of our republic. I've often wondered what monuments inspired our founding fathers. When the drafters of the Declaration of Independence proclaimed that our Creator had endowed each and every American with certain unalienable rights, what monuments inspired them? I suggest that those monuments are located right here in the ancient city of Jerusalem. We have given this plaque to the City of David Foundation with the hope that it will prompt all who read it to think of the Judeo-Christian values upon which our country was founded and how those values were inspired by ancient Jerusalem and its inhabitants." End quote. The plaque that Ambassador Friedman dedicated included the following text. "The City of David brings biblical Jerusalem to life at the very place where the kings and prophets of the Bible walked. It is this site where internationally acclaimed archaeological discoveries have been unearthed, including the Pool of Siloam, the Pilgrimage Road, the Gihon Spring, and Hezekiah's Tunnel. As the prophet Isaiah said, 'Out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Eternal from Jerusalem.' The spiritual bedrock of our values as a nation comes from Jerusalem. It is upon these ideals that the American Republic was founded and the unbreakable bond between the United States and Israel was formed. The City of David serves as a proud reminder of the glorious heritage of the United States of America." End quote. This is an amazing acknowledgement of the shared roots of the United States and the State of Israel. And Ambassador Friedman is correct to make such an acknowledgement. This is something that the Trump administration has understood, and it has sought to strengthen those historic ties to a massive degree. Now, what does this declaration in the City of David do? You could say that it doesn't mean much. However, it does carry the effect of law in the United States. This wasn't just a Trump declaration. It carries the seal of the United States of America. The United States Commission for the Preservation of America's Heritage Abroad acts according to the U.S. Public Law 9983. It was passed in 1985 and enacted in 1990. The purpose of the law that now applies to the City of David is this, quote, "Because of the fabric of our society is strengthened by visible reminders of the historical roots of the society, it is in the national interest of the United States to encourage the preservation and protection of the cemeteries, monuments, and historic buildings associated with the foreign heritage of the United States citizens." And so the Trump administration, in one of its final acts, stated that the City of David in Jerusalem, Israel, is an official part of American heritage. And under this law, it's in the national interest of America to encourage the preservation and protection of the City of David in Jerusalem, and we should say technically, in East Jerusalem. One of these last acts of the Trump administration is to say that the United States has a mandate to protect and preserve the City of David. This is incredible, and it's totally justified. But what do you think the Biden administration thinks? It seems that if they destroy the 7076 report, that they would be also just as quick to want to destroy this other declaration as well. On the one hand, you have the Trump administration that believes in the biblical origins of the Constitution of the United States, and with that acknowledging its connection to Jerusalem, and then you have the Biden administration that wants to destroy that link. It's not surprising, considering the lack of care, respect, and time that the Obama administration had for Israel, and even the City of David as well. Remember, what was the last act of the Obama administration concerning Israel? 1 month before President Obama left the White House, the United States infamously broke with its historic precedent of supporting Israel at the United Nations, an institution that has systematic bias against the Jewish state. You'll remember that at the time, collective applause erupted in the UN hall when U.S. Ambassador Samantha Powers raised her hand to allow passage of Resolution 2334, which called any Israeli settlement in the land occupied by Jordan before 1967 as illegal. According to this resolution, Israelis living in the Jewish quarter of the old city, Jerusalem, were considered squatters. By not vetoing the anti-Israel resolution, Israel's greatest ally chose to side with Israel bashers instead of the Jewish state. The Obama administration called Israel's control of the City of David illegal. And yet here you have the Trump administration, in one of their final acts, mandating that it's in America's interest to preserve the history of the City of David. The abolishment of the 1776 report and the production of the 1776 report itself highlight the fact that there is a war currently raging over Americans' history. Some hate the Constitution and all it stands for, and some want to uphold it. But even more fundamentally, it's the values of the Constitution and their roots in the ancient City of David that is under attack. Both the January 18 announcements make this connection very clear. But something that both the 1776 report and the recognition of the City of David as a place of American heritage critically miss is that America's attachment to Jerusalem is more than just spiritual. It is actually physical as well. As Herbert W. Armstrong showed in his landmark book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, America is actually made up of the descendants of the ancient Israelite tribes. Understanding this fact is critical to comprehending America's place in the world, its connection to Israel, and the direction the country is going. It also underscores why there is an effort to blot out America's history relating to Jerusalem. To understand more of this critical part of America's history and the prophecies for the future for this lost tribe of Israel, please request the United States and Britain in Prophecy.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
How quickly freedom of speech is being shut down in America today. This is something that the left in this country has been working to do for years, but it has very suddenly reached a new level of repression. There is an orthodox view, the acceptable view, and all dissident voices are being silenced. Now, the most immediate cause for this is the January 6th protest in the U.S. Capitol. This is being treated as America's new 9/11, its new Pearl Harbor. But actually, it's much more dangerous than those events because this was perpetrated by Americans who have been brainwashed by Donald Trump.
There are people who are radicalized right now, and it is going to take a very long time. And it's going to take a long time and a lot of effort to de-radicalize those people.
We have, there are millions of Americans, almost all white, almost all Republicans, who somehow need to be deprogrammed. It's as if they're members of a cult, the Trumpist cult.
How are we going to really almost deprogram these people who have signed up for the cult of Trump?
CNN went so far as to interview an actual cult expert.
So in studying all the thought reform brainwashing models, I've developed a BITE model of authoritarian control. And it basically talks about controlling behavior, information, thoughts, and emotions to create a new identity that's dependent and obedient. And this is a radical personality change in the mental health literature in the APA DSM-5. It's called a dissociative disorder, questioning of identity. And the bottom line is all of America needs deprogramming because we've all been negatively influenced by Donald Trump.
Here's former Obama official John Brennan on MSNBC.
So I know looking forward that the members of the Biden team who have been nominated or have been appointed are now moving in laser-like fashion to try to uncover as much as they can about what looks very similar to insurgency movements that we've seen overseas, mm-hmm. where they germinate in different parts of a country and they gain strength and it brings together an unholy alliance frequently of religious extremists, authoritarians, fascists, bigots, racists, nativists, even libertarians.
Commentator Jonathan Turley wrote this. A few days after the election, a law professor declared that even questioning the Biden electoral victory was tantamount to being a Holocaust denier. One professor, however, has taken this call even further by declaring such supporters are worse than the Nazis and heralding the need for the same type of treatment seen with the Nuremberg trials, including the apparent elimination of the Republican Party. This is Washington Post columnist Jennifer Rubin on MSNBC.
What we should be doing is shunning these people. Mm-hmm. Shunning, shaming these people is a statement of moral indignation that these people are not fit for polite society. I think any institution, in University of Virginia, for example, for a bit had a relationship with Mark Short, who is now back with the administration. I think it's absolutely abhorrent that any institution of higher learning, any news organization or any entertainment organization that has a news outlet would hire these people. I also want to echo something that my friend EJ said. It's not only that Trump has to lose, but that all his enablers have to lose. We have to collectively, in essence, burn down the Republican Party. We have to level them because if there are survivors, if there are people who weathered this storm, they will do it again.
So she's saying these people need to be blacklisted from universities, from being able to even hold positions. Turley wrote this. Smith College professor Loretta Ross, who teaches women's and gender studies, rejected calls for unity and instead called for punitive action against supporters in Congress, universities, and regular jobs. This is what Ross wrote. Republicans are no longer entitled to exist as a legitimate political party because this authoritarian backlash has been building since new civil rights laws were passed in 1964 and 1965 in response to white racist violence captured on TV. that required the National Guard to quell. Then President Lyndon Johnson predicted that most white people would flee the Democratic Party to join the pro-segregationist, anti-feminist, and anti-gay revanchist political movement of George Wallace, Richard Nixon, and Ronald Reagan. Every undemocratically selected Republican president since the 1960s by an electoral college designed to be disenfranchising has failed to repudiate this neo-fascist wing of their party. So she's saying this whole thing has to go. This is absolutely has no place in America today. Now, what do you think of all this? Supposedly, this is the political party that represents freedom and everyone being able to do their own thing. They're certainly very much in favor of personal freedoms or license when it comes to immorality, people being free to have sex with whomever they please, to marry whomever they please, to abort babies as they please, even to commit crimes of vandalism, arson, robbery, and assault as they please. They love it when people defy the law, if it's for a cause they support. They'll encourage it when mobs are smashing windows, looting businesses, burning cars, attacking police, destroying cities, creating mayhem. They'll applaud anarchy and say, well, it's all justified. It's all appropriate and necessary. They say this is what is needed for society to heal. But when a crowd gathers in support of President Trump, when a window is smashed at the Capitol, these people need to be deprogrammed. They need to be shut up. Their movement needs to be burned to the ground. This past year really has demonstrated just how authoritarian the radical left truly is. Their words about freedom apply very selectively. With COVID-19 as a justification, these radicals have implemented unprecedented authoritarian oppression, closing businesses, restricting travel, shutting down schools, shutting down churches, enforcing empty streets and public places, mandating social distancing and mask wearing, imposing massive fines, arresting people for crimes like going to the beach. They've invaded people's privacy. They followed people with drones. They tracked their movements through cell phone data. They said, this is what is needed for society to heal. Governors and other officials have flexed their muscles. They've talked like dictators and showed people who's boss. They speak the language of law and order. They direct that all people do exactly as they're told, and they replace constitutional rights with their own directives. Their word is law. Anyone who violates it is ignorant, irresponsible, anti-science, lawless, dangerous. Well, now we're seeing these same authoritarian measures being taken directly against anyone who would even question the idea that this past presidential election wasn't absolutely free and fair, or anyone who would express any support for what President Trump did for America. Freedom of speech in this country is under unprecedented attack. Here's Dinesh D'Souza talking about this trend in a recent video.
The legal scholar Alan Dershowitz makes the point that free speech is a very fragile value. In fact, he says that no one really believes in free speech. Seems very strange to say, but when Dershowitz teaches his class, and this was at Harvard Law School, he would come in and say, how many of you guys in the class believe in free speech? Every hand goes up, I believe in free speech. And then he would say, all right, well, let's take some specific examples. And he would start pressing people's hot button issues. How many of you think, for example, that racist speech should be outlawed? And a bunch of hands go up. How many of you think that speech demeaning to women should be outlawed? And some more hands go up. And down the list he goes, and some of the issues might be, how many of you think that blasphemy should be outlawed? How many of you think that insulting remarks about really fat people should be outlawed? More hands go up. And eventually he looks around the room and he realizes very few hands are down. In other words, free speech is something that people affirm in theory, But when push comes to shove, they don't believe it. They are intolerant.
The idea is we cannot be tolerant of intolerant people, which, of course, makes the concept of tolerance meaningless. Only tolerating those who think exactly like you do is not tolerance. What the left is increasingly enforcing here, the politicians, the media industry, the technology companies, is fundamentally anti-American. But even more than that, if you really understand what's going on here, you see that it is actually an attack on God. To truly grasp what is happening, you have to understand a few things about God. God created human beings. He created us for a marvelous purpose with an incredible potential. He gave us intellectual ability and creative capacity that he didn't give to animals. He gave us emotion, relationships with others, love, a sense of morality, of right and wrong. He created us to learn to think, to plan, design, produce, and even create as he does. And he has thrilling, exciting plans for our future to help us grow in our capacity, in our capability, our responsibility, our character. He gave us dominion over the material world. This gives us opportunity to learn how to build and care for things. He created marriage and family to teach us how to care for others, to develop teamwork and unity, selflessness and sacrifice. He also gave his law governing our relationships within family and in society, and even how we take care of the earth and material things. He created an economic system based around private property ownership to teach us opportunity and accountability, stewardship and hard work, industry and creativity, and voluntary charity toward our neighbors. Our Creator wants to help us grow up. By being accountable for our own choices, we learn to strive for excellence, to grow in duty, authority, and capacity to help others. He wants us to live productive, noble lives where we build strong families, prosperity, right ambition, strong moral fiber, and solid character. And as we do that, we are preparing for the wonderful future he has in store for us. You can read what the Bible reveals about that by reading our free book by Herbert W. Armstrong, The Incredible Human Potential. God is a God of freedom. He wants people to be free to fulfill our fullest potential. And this truth about God is beautifully expressed in America's Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. In modern times, God has used America and Britain to give more freedom and prosperity to more people than any place else in history. People of every race, color, and creed, we should note. And that's something that all of us in these nations should be extremely grateful for. So think about these goals and purposes of God as you look at what's happening in America today. Everything God wants to accomplish in the lives of human beings, the left is working to dismantle. What's happening with the vitiation of our freedom of speech and freedom of religion? This is actually the advanced stages of their efforts to strip people of the freedoms God gave us. And even more, it's meant to prevent people from fulfilling their God-given potential. God encourages freedom within his moral law, true liberty that comes from strong individual character. The left encourages moral license. It encourages all sorts of immorality that debases individuals and fragments families and destroys lives. That behavior destroys true freedom. As Jesus Christ said, whoever commits sin is a slave of sin. And the weaker the families are, the more they need to rely on the government for support. The left encourages dependency. They always tend towards socialistic and communistic practices, which takes decision-making power away from individuals and families and transfers it to government officials. As governments take people's wealth and they redistribute it the way they want to, this inevitably suppresses people's personal motivation and ambition. It strips people of responsibility, and it makes them shiftless and idle. So rather than striving for excellence, people settle into self-satisfaction and mediocrity. And the bureaucratic process of redistributing wealth always costs a lot of wealth, which causes the overall standard of living to drop. And it also kills off the opportunity and the desire to demonstrate individual charity. The government takes care of the poor, and it takes your money to do it. There's nothing voluntary about it. And when poor people receive that kind of charity, rather than feeling gratitude, they feel entitled. And if anything interrupts the flow of those benefits, they get really agitated and angry. By contrast, God encourages private property ownership, which encourages industry and stewardship. It prepares people for ever greater capacity and duty and authority. It also obliges people to be accountable for their choices. Socialist government, the left, insulates people from the consequences of bad decisions. It robs people of their individual dignity. And really, it turns people into wards of the state. At its heart, the authoritarian left wants to put itself in place of God. They want people looking to them instead of to God. And throughout history, the more authoritarian the leader, the more he creates a kind of religion of the state. And on top of that, the greater the role the government plays in people's lives, the more power it has to trample economic and social freedoms, which is exactly what it does, inevitably. This is all exactly the opposite of what God wants for us. And it all springs from a satanic impulse to destroy people, to strip them of freedom and prevent them from growing and building and creating the way God intends. Satan always comes as an angel of light. He couches everything he does in marvelous language about social justice and equality and compassion, but at its core, this movement is anti-God. It is against God, and it's destructive of God's plan for human beings. And the better you know God, the easier it is to recognize a counterfeit. God is a God of freedom. And America has been a bastion of freedom since its beginning. Freedom that was earned at a very high cost. And you know, these freedoms have enabled the work of God to thrive here from even before those freedoms were enshrined in the Bill of Rights. I want to read a few paragraphs to you from our free book, The True History of the True Church. We'll link to this in our show notes for today's program. In 1620, Puritan pilgrims struck out to obtain, among other things, religious freedom. Establishing colonies in the New World inspired the aspirations of many people who disagreed with the unbiblical practices of the Church of England and were disenchanted with the religious situation in England. A man named Roger Williams had moved to the Massachusetts Bay Colony in 1631. He was enthralled with the potential freedoms of the New World. However, he soon found himself in serious disagreement with the heads of the Puritan government established in the colony. Puritan leaders insisted that civil government had a divinely ordained right to impose Puritan religious views on its subjects. They strongly rejected the authority of Rome, but replaced it with their own intolerance. Roger Williams believed that the civil government had the right to enforce public morality, but it did not have the right to restrain religious conscience. He believed individuals had the right to choose how to worship. He insisted on the separation of church and state. You know, it's interesting because there are some religious people who say this was a mistake in America's founding, that separation of church and state has caused too many problems. But the reality is, where there is no separation of church and state, there is oppression of one over the other. And anyone who disagrees with the state-approved church ends up being persecuted for their religion. And what's happening in America today is essentially a secular version of state religion that is being upheld with very strong vehemence. Outside the ancient nation of Israel, God's true religion has never been the state religion in any nation. It has always had to operate outside the authority of the state. So throughout history, it's been persecuted. It's been hunted and hounded and exiled at times. Now, in America, it's had a much happier history. Our church history book continues. Eventually, Williams had to flee Massachusetts. In 1636, he formed in Rhode Island a new but small society where total religious freedom was permitted by law and where the majority ruled in all civil affairs. In 1643, he sailed to England to obtain a charter for the new colony, and by 1647, the colony's unique set of laws was established. In Mystery of the Ages, Herbert W. Armstrong wrote, "Rhode Island was the first place in the world to guarantee freedom of religion as a basic tenet of its constitution." And the church history book continues, "This colony soon became a safe refuge for those expressing different religious beliefs. Many Baptists and Quakers who'd experienced severe religious intolerance in the other colonies migrated to Rhode Island. This colony set a standard that would soon be adopted by the fledgling United States of America." The freedom of religion and the freedom of speech in America has provided God's work and God's true church safe harbor for nearly 400 years. It is precious liberty that we must not take for granted. And it's far more fragile than we'd like to think. And right now, under a Biden administration, it is being seriously threatened, and it could be lost overnight. Amos 7 is a prophecy we've been talking a lot about lately regarding the time of Jeroboam, when God's work will be driven out of the country, by all appearances, through an unconstitutional power grab. It says the land won't be able to bear all the words of God's man and God's work. And the context shows there is a time coming very soon when freedom of speech and freedom of religion will be stamped out in America, certainly as far as God's work is concerned. Then in the very next chapter, Amos 8, the prophet Amos describes a famine of the word, a famine, he says, not of bread nor a thirst for water, but of hearing the words of the Eternal. And they shall wander from sea to sea, and from north even to the east. They shall run to and fro to seek the word of the Eternal and shall not find it. The time of people being able to freely access the truth of God is nearly over. Soon, people will be searching everywhere and they won't be able to find it. Right now, many Americans are deeply concerned about the threat to free speech and the danger to freedom of religion. The storm clouds of authoritarianism and oppression are gathering. Take advantage of the freedoms you have while you can. Seek the Eternal while he may be found, Isaiah 55, verse 6 says. Call you upon him while he is near. And to those of us doing the work of God, Jesus Christ says, as recorded in John 9 and verse 4, we must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no man can work. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Jeremiah Jacques and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Thomas Paine. The greatest tyrannies are always perpetuated in the name of the noblest of causes. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.